This week's episode of This Is Only a Test is made possible by Ops Genie, because incidents happen. Thankfully, Ops Genie empowers devs and ops teams to plan for service disruptions and stay in control during incidents. It also gives teams the power to respond quickly and efficiently to unplanned issues and helps notify all the right people through a smart combination of scheduling and escalation paths. With Ops Genie, your next incident doesn't stand a chance. Visit opsgenie.com to sign up for a free company account and add up to five team members. That's opsgenie.com. Never miss a critical alert again with Ops Genie.
Hey, let's start the show.
For Thursday, December 20th, 2018, welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.
Do animals talk in this dimension? Because I don't want to freak them out.
.com. Hey everyone, I'm Norm, and welcome to this week's episode, which may possibly be not only the last episode before Christmas, but the last episode of 2018. To be determined, we'll see whether our team, whether my fellow podcast hosts will make themselves available next week between Christmas and the new year.
What if we don't? Do you publish a classic episode?
That is what I'm thinking. I'm going to dig up from the archive a classic episode of This Is Only a Test and an encore presentation, if you would. Pull it from the archives, maybe.
Ads and everything.
Well, I mean, maybe I'll pull one from like years ago before we had ads.
Oh, wow.
Maybe I'll get one from the first year. Oh, that'd be so scary.
That'd be great.
That'd be a nightmare. A Christmas miracle. It's a wonderful life, except it's all bad in the past. Anyway, welcome to the episode this week. Joined, of course, you heard him already, Jeremy Williams.
What's up?
And Kishore Hari.
Hello.
Appropriate that the core crew is here for the end of the year. And it's been quite a busy week here at the Tested office. If you have been following us on social media or been on the site lately, you may know that we're doing live streams on Twitch this week as a part of Twitch's Inspector Gadget Marathon. So we had actually just wrapped up filming today's build segment with our pal Daryl Maloney.
You're kind of blowing away the Twitch audience because they're not used to this level of quality. You've got the crisp video. You've got the
Oh, you mean production quality, not content quality.
No, absolutely the production quality.
Because they're not talking about the content quality.
I'm watching the streams and people in chat are saying, I didn't know it could look this good.
You're wrong, Norm. People are loving the content too.
Thank you.
And let me just say, I was in the Twitch chat today and there was at least a 30-minute discussion on blue tape.
Nice. That's all we want for people. These are the serious things that we think about. We are building some props inspired by the Inspector Gadget TV show. And you're right, Jeremy. It is a different style of live stream production, certainly that we've been accustomed to because we've never done it before. But for some Twitch viewers that they're not accustomed to, because a lot of people don't have the production capabilities that we have, the camera rigs, the video mixer. Of course, that what they do have, though, is maybe experience that we don't have, and the overlays and all that interactive fun and goodness, because we're not playing video games. We're building stuff.
But you do have the chat, and you do have the engagement with the audience.
Well, we have to.
That's what it's all about.
That's what we're finding out. That's what people want.
That's fun to watch.
Yeah. It's weird. I really was skeptical because it literally is watching paint dry sometimes.
It is. Sanding and paint dry.
But it's actually been quite entertaining to watch the builds come together because you see multiple aspects of that planning process come to fruition in short order.
The real-time feedback is really nice, and we're learning a lot for sure.
Watching you guys do that made me think, what if we did the podcast live? And I'm curious. We talked about the pros and cons of that. I'm curious to our listeners what you guys think, if that would be fun or if that would be a bad thing. Like, if you listen to the MP3, do you feel like you've missed something because you weren't there for the live event? Or does the live event make it something special because you can do some level of engagement?
You know, Kishore looks skeptical. I am definitely skeptical.
Yeah. I'm here live every week. They're not missing a thing.
You know, we've done, I think, I can count probably on one hand the number of times that we've recorded a podcast with a live audience. We've done it with one time. I think Dallas watched us podcast and sat in the corner there.
Yeah.
And I love Dallas. Love you, man. But it was not the same.
It made it different.
It made it different.
I also just apologized to him for like 2 hours consecutive.
Right.
Like,
knowing people watch this and listen to this, because I think the best podcasts, at least this style of conversational podcasts, are the podcasts that we do for each other in the room here. And where you guys, we love you and thank you for listening. And we want you to feel like you're here with us. But when I'm cognizant of the fact that thousands of people are listening out there, that throws me off.
Interesting. So you have felt thrown off doing the Twitch stream, you would say that.
Totally.
Interesting.
Versus doing something I know that can be edited, can't have any, that safety net.
See, but I think of it as working without a net, and that increases the energy level.
No.
Maybe it makes it something different. Maybe it's just... It's
something different for sure.
Maybe it's a skill that you just needs more practice.
Work that muscle, that net, live stream muscle.
Net, no net, I'm still going to fall down. Doesn't matter.
you want to Flying Graysons it.
Hey, before we move into the biggest story, I wanted to share something I did 2 weeks ago now, because I forgot to share it last week, and that's I got to see Cirque du Soleil. I saw the Volta performance here in San Francisco, and every time I see these guys, I feel like it's just one of the great privileges of being human to be able to go and watch their performance. It is always just mind-blowing what these guys do with the acrobatics and the set design and the costumes and the live music. You don't even realize the music is live. They don't even make a big deal out of it. But all the musicians are in the back room following the performance, orchestrating to it.
And I love theater. I love
that aspect.
Theater performance, but I've never seen a Cirque du Soleil.
What?
Ever.
I would say you must. I would say it's one of these things you must do in life.
You know, normally I'd advocate for the big theater, like the Las Vegas theaters. I think a lot of people recommend, their, water-based show.
Yep.
But I have to say there is an intimacy about the San Francisco, this traveling show that comes by. They literally just pop up a tent. And it is oddly intimate.
It's serious tent, but it isn't. It isn't. Like, there's not a bad seat.
No, but it feels like a throwback to, like, the circuses that you would see in Batman with the Flying Graysons.
A traveling troupe.
Yeah, there's better light rigging and all the tent is a lot fancier. But you're sitting in that kind of like slightly raked circular fashion.
It is kind of theater in the round. The theme of this show in particular, Volta, I think would appeal to you. I think maybe you would be offended or like...
What is it?
Maybe it's like...
Is it electricity?
Maybe it's making fun of you and you wouldn't like
robots?
That. No, technology. There's a theme of the show, which is that we have become obsessed with our screens, and there's these characters that walk around the stage just focused on their cell phone screen, not looking up, and they're all dressed alike. It looks like a Terry Gilliam film. And one of the actors breaks free from that and does these amazing gymnastics and meets people who do amazing things with their bodies.
So there's a narrative.
It's like, to really understand it, you have to like read the book. It's all very visual.
There's a book?
Yeah, you can get, like, somebody handed us a book on the way out and because they were done reading it. My daughter loved the show. They turned around and handed it to her.
A book as in like theater style?
Like you walk in, you like buy the $10 book.
Not like a novel.
No. Okay. It's more like a magazine. But,
got it. There's a name for it. It's not the book as in like the lyrics, because when you talk about theater, musical theater, the book is... The songs.
No.
You're talking about like, what is the name for this? It's the upsell.
Right? Yes, it is an upsell.
Yeah.
It's merch.
Yes.
Is what it is.
Yes.
But it's not important. The important thing is that it's to describe a Cirque du Soleil show is to describe like an acid trip. It's visually and thematically just weird. It is just weird stuff. And the things that they do acrobatically are equally weird and insane, like beyond what you think people are capable of.
Contortionism?
There isn't a contortionist in this episode, but there was an amazing like trampoline scene where they're jumping out of windows, like a three-story structure, and falling and then levitating back into different windows and onto the roof. And it just is amazing to see the orchestration that they're capable of. The finale is a BMX scene, of all things. And I wonder where they found these guys, but they have, half a dozen super talented BMX stunt bike people, and they go up these half pipes, and there's this big surface that's floating above the audience the entire show. You're like, what is that? And they finally lower it down, and it's a wall that they can sort of rebound off of up in the air. It's an astounding show.
I have a feeling that every like ex-Olympian that doesn't become instantly famous, they end up at Cirque du Soleil. Because you can imagine like the BMX bikers that
participate.
Are they all French?
Well, it is a French company, but I would bet that the BMX bikers are not necessarily French. Hmm. I mean, I imagine that they were BMX bikers and recruited into Cirque du Soleil. Like they weren't born into the circus life, which some people are. There are twins that are part of this show. Like there's clearly people who have been doing this a long time.
The program, that's what I'm thinking about. That's what you call it, right? You buy the, not the playbill.
No.
But the program.
The upsell.
The upsell, the program.
Yes. Okay, now on to what you really want to talk about.
What? I was going to say, regarding Cirque du Soleil, and maybe getting a little ahead of ourselves,
yep.
For people who can't make it to Vegas or don't live in cities that they travel to, it's also filmed in 360 3D video to view in VR headsets. Felix and Paul have an app, I believe, for the Oculus Go, and you can watch Cirque du Soleil performances, at least a version of a cut-down version of it. And I think you've watched one, and of course you've seen Cirque du Soleil performances.
Yep.
Would you say that VR headset captures some of the magic?
It captures the tone. It doesn't capture the acrobatic, astounding things that they're capable of.
The physical choreography.
The physicality of these performances, that's not the point of those VR captures. Those are more about 360 experiences that you can turn around, rewatch, look in a different direction, and they're fine. Like, those are fine. They give you a taste of it, but it's more of like a taste of the show that happens between the set pieces.
Got it. Okay, let's move on to our...
story this week.
I've been waiting so long to talk about this.
Oh my god, we're talking about Aquaman, aren't we?
No, Will Smith is the genie.
What? That's what he left Tessa to do? To be the genie? Oh boy. No.
Oh my god.
Now, for our last podcast of the year, we'll be talking a little bit about tech, but the world of tech right now is just so depressing. 2018 as a whole, a lot of downs, maybe more downs than highs in the year, and especially there's a lot of stuff that we're in the midst of right now in technology, with privacy concerns, with hearings in Congress, with revelations about what companies are doing with our data, that just is not fun at all. And even looking at like the products of the year, not so great. But the one shining beacon of 2018, it's got to be Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Here we are. The trailer looked good.
We talked about the trailer on the podcast. I believe you guys watched the trailer for this, and I was hyped. My hype level was here.
And then the Rotten Tomatoes reviews came out, and were 100%.
100%. I think it did dip down to 98, maybe 97% even. But
this is when I went on the Joey Fimmelli diet, and I tried to like stop the hype train because it was starting to leave the station.
Yeah, so what we're going to do, because the movie, a bunch of people saw it. It was not a breakout hit. You know, like a MCU cinematic movie. It didn't make $100 million over the weekend. It made like $35 million. So plenty of you out there, I imagine, have not yet had a chance to watch Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. But we're going to talk about the film, and we're going to first talk about it without spoilers, give our impressions. But we will go into a lengthy, spoiler-filled discussion of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. And that may go... We'll give ourselves a time limit out for this, so you can jump ahead if you need to. But it is, I think, not only the top, there is interesting technology in this to make it worthy of technology, but it is the top story this week and maybe even of the month.
The budget for the movie, by the way, $90 million.
Reasonable.
Yeah, very reasonable.
Very reasonable.
Less than half of like a Marvel film.
Or a Pixar film.
Yeah.
Those can cost well into 100. I mean, a lot of that is in the years and the years of work. This is 4 years in the making. So this is a Sony film. To preface it, it is not part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Now, Sony has the rights for Spider-Man. They have the rights to produce Spider-Man and characters in the Spider-Man universe in any of its mediums, whether it's animation, live action. And they do have a deal with Disney and Marvel to produce and to lend Spider-Man for films like Infinity War, Civil War, Endgame, presumably, and it's kind of a trade because Tony Stark was in the Spider-Man Homecoming film.
Did you see the Deadpool Fred Savage clips where it's like a Princess Bride?
Yes, this is a re-release of Deadpool on Fox.
Like the PG-13 version of
yes.
Deadpool?
Yeah.
And there's a scene where they talk about that. Like Fred Savage, like it's Deadpool says, it's a Marvel film. And Fred Savage is like, well, it's not really a Marvel
not
film.
Not really a Marvel film. And I don't know how many of the lay people out there, people, just moviegoers, the movie-going public care or know the distinctions between, quote-unquote, the canonical MCU films versus the rights. You know, some people just want to see a Venom film. Some people just want to see the Deadpool film. And some people just want to see an X-Men film. Some people want to see the, you know, and maybe they are asking the questions why the X-Men aren't in Infinity War. And that's why there are podcasts like this to help explain it. But long story short, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, not part of the MCU in any capacity. Maybe that's one of the reasons it didn't have as much awareness despite the very, very strong reviews. It is an animated film. That could also be something going against it because I think all of us in the room, when we first saw the very first images, not the trailer, but the images for this, the poster, we thought this look, it could have been a direct-to-DVD, like in a parallel universe. This would have been a direct-to-DVD film without a theatrical release.
Not with that kind of animation style.
But it was, I mean, I'm saying, like conceptually, this could have been something made for TV.
Yep.
But they put in the effort, and not only the writing, the directing, but also, as you alluded to, the animation style above and beyond. Money well spent. It's produced by Phil Lord, Chris Miller, who are the creative geniuses behind the 22 Jump Street reboots, the Lego Movie, Last Man on Earth, and also were the first people who directed Solo before they were taken off the project. And Phil Lord, I believe, was also a co-writer on this. Now, let's do a poll across the room.
Okay.
Do you want to do this out of 100 rating percent-wise, out of 5 stars, thumbs up, thumbs down?
You know,
what do you want to do?
Whatever. You give your review the way you want to give it. What do you think?
I'm trying to hold back my superlatives, but...
Really?
I'm not going to go as far to say my favorite movie of the year.
Oh.
Because I don't know yet. And I may
because
need
now's
to
when the good movies
because
come
I
out.
Also may need to... I haven't, like, surveyed it. I'm in the high right now. In the week after watching it, but easily my favorite superhero movie this year.
That hurts me.
I know. And maybe the best superhero movie, my favorite superhero movie ever.
Oh my gosh. It's not, it isn't quite that because it's for you, for me,
subjective.
Yeah. For it's easily the best Spider-Man movie ever.
Easily. Oh my God.
I walked out of this movie stunned. The first thing I did was I watched it with my son and my wife, and my son was basically like just chatting normally, like he liked the movie and stuff, but I wasn't talking after walking out, and he was kind of bugging me, and I was like, hang on, I gotta send a message to Norm and Jeremy. And all I wrote was holy shit, Into the Spider-Verse is all I wrote to you guys.
Yeah, I remembered that.
I was just astounded. We can go on and on about the animation style. I was astounded at the depth of story and how they made some very difficult choices in that story and did it unapologetically.
It is end-to-end, I think, more entertaining, more rewatchable. I can't wait to watch it again. Then Infinity War and Black Panther, which are my other two favorite superhero movies this year.
I need to rewatch Infinity War and Black Panther because I remember really liking both of those.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But I haven't seen them since the theater.
Wow.
So I need to watch those.
Infinity
again.
War over time, with every reviewing, it feels more like the first Guardians for me in that it's very rewatchable, but there are parts that I love and parts that I think do drag a little bit because it's a very long film.
You said we could go on and about the visuals. I'd like to take a moment and go on about them. Because
give me your review. Your score, your rating.
My problem is the visuals were so much better than anything else about the film, in my opinion.
For you?
For me.
Okay.
Like they were so good that it was hard for me to appreciate how good the story was, the plot, the sound. That was all good too, but the visuals were something new.
Yeah.
And so, I don't feel like the plot was not predictable, you know? I feel like the plot, to me, it just, I saw the turns coming. I was not surprised. It was like the lines didn't hit me the way that they wanted. That
oh my God.
The movie wanted to. Ooh. But the visuals like were totally mind blowing for me. Like I've never seen a movie anything like that. There's been a few movies in my life that have struck
Toy
me this
Story.
Way. Like
I think Toy Story this was a Toy Story moment.
Waking Life was that way. In some ways, like Moulin Rouge. You know, just movies that were totally different. And Speed Racer. Is a movie in that vein.
Now, I think Speed Racer it fits in that category of like it is a the visuals sell the movie because some of the acting and some of the story don't necessarily hold up. And it's I love that movie. I would watch any day. But this, and we'll talk about the story, but we can talk about the visuals, which doesn't give away the plot and which isn't a spoiler
exactly.
discussion. So technically, it is an animated film, a modern computer animated film, right? So they are designing characters that are three-dimensional, rendered, building sets and environments on the computer. Now, we've seen rendered films try to have a maybe cel-shaded or flat aesthetic before. Mm-hmm. And we've seen it done to great effect both in video games and in post-processed and huge computationally animated blockbuster films. What I read about for this film, which has itself a very stylized look, is that not only did they render out the films, there was hand-done work on every frame afterward.
Okay.
Accents, not just like some in visual effects, when you're talking about like a Pixar or a Disney animation film, mm-hmm. there'll be systems built, right? A rendering engine built for the environments,
yeah.
for the characters. And then there'll be actually a special effects division built for like... visual effects like water or fire or just the glow and the look of the film, but those are, and then there's a lot of hand stuff done, of course, in terms of design of characters and animation. Here, there's a one extra post process touch that's a per frame done tweak on each frame to add an accent to make it look like. It's out of a comic book.
That's a lot of work. Was Spider-Ham 2D, was he drawn, or was he also 3D?
He was also 3D, rendered differently.
Okay, interesting. Because I could have imagined that character in particular was just drawn.
Roger Rabbit style.
Mm-hmm.
Right, like where, as opposed to live action plus cell animation, you're talking about CG animation plus cell animation.
Yeah.
Right? That was just different shader. But they would do things, you know, Ang Lee's Hulk... was probably the most notable superhero film to try to incorporate the medium of comic books, from the text voiceovers to literally panning across panels using the frame of the cinema.
Yeah.
And you had some of that here, but amped up. Like it is unrelenting in its visual flourish.
Yeah, and I, to some degree, kind of exhausting. Like I want to watch this movie in slow motion.
Yeah, I mean, we're not giving away anything with this, but the ending especially is visually accosting. It's like the brightness, the vividness of those final scenes really were hard to decipher things at points.
We're old. Maybe this is a movie made for the younger audience.
No, come on. You got to admit, like in these action scenes, there's so much visual information happening at once. It was hard to take it all in.
I loved it. I saw it in Dolby Cinema.
Yeah,
and
it was gorgeous. Yes, a lot of information being thrown at me, but it not to a point where I was getting like seizures or my head was hurting.
No. I'm not suggesting it.
It was just a lot.
There's a lot of detail that was hard to take in because you're focused on like the main point of action.
I saw it in XD. It has excellent surround sound. Mm-hmm. This movie does.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's the first movie in a while that I've wanted to re-see maybe in 3D because the visuals were so inventive that I'll bet they did some interesting things with 3D.
Mm. All right. Should we get into spoiler talk?
I loved it. I think it's my favorite superhero movie of the year. Kishore loved it. Best Spider-Man movie ever made. Mm-hmm. Jeremy thinks worth going simply for the visuals alone.
Yes, I think
but a little more of a predictable plot.
I think it's going to be that that 4K Blu-ray that is your demo disc.
Mm.
Yeah,
interesting. All right, wow, Coco be damned. and now we will go into, let's say, for the next 15 minutes. Can we do that? Oh yeah, let's do. If you're watching the video on YouTube, we're going to change the background color red.
That one's red
for Spider-Man. Behind Kishore means that we are in spider spoiler territory. Now, we're not going to go beat by beat for the film, but we will establish this is Miles Morales, mm-hmm. Spider-Man, not Peter Parker Spider-Man, as a protagonist. And Miles Morales, for those who don't know, and for Jeremy, who maybe doesn't read the comic books.
Definitely not.
Was a character created by writer Byron Michael Bendis and Sarah Pacelli, artist, for the Ultimate Universe. So Marvel, back in early 2000s.
Oh, this is not that old.
No.
Yeah, so back in the early 2000s, Marvel created a new line of comic books, an imprint. It would called the Ultimate Universe. And because up until the early thousands, the continuity of characters, the Spider-Man that we knew from the 60s, was technically the same Spider-Man. Obviously, Spider-Man would get updated from time to time, but Marvel wasn't doing that thing. It was a conceit of the storytelling, right? Spider-Man now has a cell phone, sure, or now has a DSLR when there weren't DSLRs back then, but it was technically the same Peter Parker.
Same dude.
The same dude, the same universe, the stories.
Did he grow up?
He grew up.
Okay.
And he grew up, and a lot of people in the 90s reading Spider-Man grew up reading a Spider-Man that had gone through college, that married Mary Jane. And Marvel felt at the end of the 20th century that that was maybe not as relatable, and they wanted a new audience. So they created they rebooted Spider-Man, essentially. But they didn't reboot it by killing off or by stopping the Amazing Spider-Man comics. They created a new Ultimate Spider-Man comics. And hugely successful. It was Brian Michael Bendis and, oh my God, the artist Peter Bagley, I want to say, did this. And it was Spider-Man back in high school. But a little more of a modern take. So not like edgy modern, but like just dealing with the issues that a kid in growing up in the early thousands would be dealing with, and reinvented the Green Goblin to be less of a guy wearing a mask and more of a genetically enhanced
like
character,
a monster,
And hugely popular. And this brought in not only new audiences, but also people, old fans of Spider-Man, loved this take on Spider-Man. Now, the Ultimate Universe, eventually, there were a lot of different characters. There was Ultimate X-Men. There was the Ultimate Avengers, which the Avengers in the MCU are actually hugely inspired by this modern take on the Avengers team. That whole imprint of the Ultimate Universe eventually ran its course. And they wanted to not be afraid to let these characters not just grow old, but go through big changes. Anyone could die. And so there was a big plot point in the Ultimate Spider-Man comics where Brian Michael Bendis killed off Peter Parker. Peter Parker was shot in the chest, saving, I believe, Captain America, shot by the Punisher. And he died. Like, that Peter Parker of the Ultimate Universe died. It was hugely tragic. No coming back.
Wow.
But at the same time, Brian Michael Bendis then created a new character, Miles Morales, out of whole cloth. This is just his own invention. Kid living in New York.
African-American?
Half African-American, half Latino.
Mm-hmm.
Living in Brooklyn. And he takes on them. He was bitten up, then gets bitten by a radioactive spider. At first becomes a fan of Peter Parker and that Spider-Man. And then he has to take on the mantle because Peter Parker dies.
Wow.
And the character of Miles Morales in the comic books, in the Ultimate Universe, became so resonant, so popular, so well written as a believable character that when Marvel decided to stop the Ultimate lines, they did this whole big event.
Right? Which was how long? How long was Miles Morales around?
For like a couple years.
A couple years,
but being the sole, I think like 4 or 5 years being the sole Spider-Man in the Ultimate Universe.
Mm-hmm.
When Marvel decided, let's just reset everything. We're actually going to create this Ultimate Extinction event and destroy this line of comics.
Oh my gosh.
He was the only character they decided then to preserve and let him get folded in to the Spider-Man universe that people from the 60s had been reading.
And just to give you a sense of the timeline, Miles Morales doesn't show up to like 2011.
Yeah.
So, in terms of when he was created.
Right.
So this is a new character, new everything.
Mm-hmm. And the reason for that was, you know, the idea behind this Ultimate Comics line was that here are the takes on the characters that you know and love that Stan Lee and Steve Ditko created with a modern, fresh spin. Green Goblin is a little bit different. He's more of a genetic monster. Peter Parker lives in the early thousands. You have to live in the wake of September 11th and that kind of stuff. And once they had run through all those stories, you know, fought the Vulture, fought the Sinister Six, they built out the universe and it got maybe too complicated, and they decided to hit the reset button. But the fans would not have it, and so Marvel said we're going to keep Miles Morales around, explained it through comic book logic, and folded him into the 616 universe, which is what we call canonically the universe that was created in the 60s. So that's still a little different than the Miles Morales we see in this movie.
Does that tie into the post-credit sequence?
Not really. Not really.
No, but you follow my logic, right?
I do follow your logic. Okay. And we'll get to that. So I'm glad that in the movie, Into the Spider-Verse, the Miles Morales we see is not the Miles Morales, and that the universe that we see isn't the Ultimate Universe. That would be too much to explain.
For me to handle.
Too much. So what you do get, though, is a universe where Spider-Man has been Spider-Man for 10 years. They lay this out. I love this. And this is not the Jake Johnson's Spider-Man that you see in the movie trailer. It is a veteran Spider-Man, and one of the
defeated Spider-Man
parts that I love about this film, Miles Morales is great, is that we, as fans of Spider-Man, reading Spider-Man growing up, those of us who read the Peter Parker, who married Mary Jane, who was in Civil War in the comic books, mm-hmm. the late 20s, early 30s-year-old Peter Parker, we've never seen on screen a mature Spider-Man. A confident Spider-Man. Think about all the movie iterations of Spider-Man, from Tobey Maguire to Andrew Garfield to Tom Holland. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a remix of the same story.
This one, smart kid,
puberty. It's a metaphor for puberty.
This is an emotionally defeated Spider-Man, which is really different.
This Spider-Man has all the confidence of James T. Kirk.
And they found the most handsomest voice they could find to voice this, Chris Pine playing James T. Kirk. They didn't announce this at all. It was like a surprise casting, but Chris Pine voices.
You didn't know, but going in?
No.
Oh, wow.
No. The Spider-Man in the Miles Morales universe, and he is confident. I love this. Yeah. I love that he goes into a fight, talks about, like, you kids stay here, I'm going to take care of this fight in Kingpin. And then it's kind of a twist that he gets killed.
That was stunning. I mean, like, I knew from the storyline that that happens. And then when they do it, I was like, what just happened? Yeah. I was speechless for a while.
The killer punch.
Yeah. And I get why it happened, but it was such a gut punch to watch it from Miles' perspective.
Oh, my God. Because Miles is the avatar for you, for kids, the fans of Spider-Man. Because in that universe, it's kind of like the Uber Spider-Man, the Spider-Man that encapsulates, you know, in the flashbacks, they have hints of Raimi with the upside down kiss and the car flying in the window. Yeah. You have the meta awareness of the Christmas songs, a Spider-Man who has Spider-Man comic books in that universe.
They flipped the Raimi kiss though, right?
They did. It's Mary Jane who's upside down. And when he is in the restaurant eating and the car flies at him, which was in Spider-Man 3, he's in costume as well.
I will say, like, you'd never see superheroes die in superhero movies. Ever.
They and gave you the taste.
We saw half of them just get killed in the last one. But you know, whatever.
That's part one. Give me part two and they'll all come back somehow.
So they gave us the taste, which like I thought was just enough of a taste, and I was emotional watching this Spider-Man die, and then they gave us the funeral. And that was my first ugly cry.
The funeral was exceptional.
Oh my God.
So I want to highlight some other things that I thought were brilliant. How they handled Spider-Man's origin story was brilliant.
The mechanism, the storytelling device.
It just was like, we get it, you know it, here it is in 20 seconds, gone. And then like they repeated it as the alternate
Spider-Man. It became a motif, and it also establishes the differences, which were how many years you've been doing it. And visually you can see, oh, okay, that's a different Spider-Man because the Kingpin or the goblin they're fighting is different, or minor differences.
I get it. It was just note perfect. Two, just like the little details on the characters made them all feel really lived in. Like Spider-Gwen had a gap in her teeth and like wasn't quite polished.
Did you think that Spider-Man in the Miles Morales universe in the movie needed to be blonde? I was actually hoping for a redheaded Spider-Man so it could be a Scarlet Spider illusion.
No, I mean, there's so many different Spider-Men that could show up here.
Are you talking about Spider-Gwen?
No.
No, he's talking about defeated Spider-Man, fat Spider-Man.
Oh.
No, not fat Spider-Man. Oh. Confident Spider-Man.
Oh, confident, the original one.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, instead of being blonde, what you're saying.
Right?
Not necessary.
Okay. We also had, leading up to before Miles Morales, because he lives in a world now where Spider-Man has died, right? Which is...
So explain to me why he gets bitten by a radioactive spider. Like, what, in the sewer while he's spray painting? Why? How did Alchemax. That happen?
Alchemax.
Who?
Alchemax.
Right.
Because where
are
he
they?
Was spraying,
are they beneath Alchemax?
They are beneath Alchemax.
Okay.
Because where he is, where his uncle Aaron leads him, to is kind of like why Uncle Aaron knows that's there is because he's working for Kingpin. And so it's close to where Alchemax is, and that's where the spider is. Number 42 is actually an important part of the Ultimate Spider-Man universe.
Oh, yeah, it shows up multiple times.
My son asked about that.
42, the reason it's 42 in the metaverse, in our world, mm-hmm. Brian Michael Bendis numbered it because it is Jackie Robinson's number.
Oh, really?
And in the comic book, it's the lottery number of Miles Morales that he gets into the school using. And so it is a symbol of him being having this responsibility of living up to his parents and holding the burden of this first generation going to this school and having the responsibility. It's a twist on great power and great responsibility, not just great superpower, but, you know, as a kid living in New York and carrying the hopes and dreams of your parents, it's that responsibility.
I loved that scene, by the way, when he's spray painting with his uncle down in the sewer. The music there is fantastic.
Oh, the music.
The visuals of it is also great.
This is why I don't think Marvel could have done this film, is they wouldn't have that library. You know, Sony, Columbia, and the most organic product placement ever with Miles Morales wearing Sony headphones, listening to a library of Sony artists, work so great.
They were playing like a mix mash of 80s hip-hop, Run DMC and Black Sheep, and I really dug it. I went on to the soundtrack, though, and it's not there. A lot of the music from the movie is not on the soundtrack. I was disappointed by that. Side note.
All right, I'm going to harp on another origin story thing. I love how they didn't fill in all the details you needed for backstories. You didn't get a ton of backstory on his uncle, but you got, like, the one line from his dad. Like, he's made choices, or whatever, however he framed it. You didn't get the backstory on the Kingpin and his family. You got enough of it, right? You got like 15 seconds. This movie never babied you. And then when it really tried to make a point, it made one in a really unique way. I thought Leap of Faith was one of the best points ever about a character in a superhero movie.
So the young Miles Morales asks old Spider-Man, "How will I know when I'm ready?"
Said you won't.
And Chris Pine says you won't.
Nope, Jake Johnson.
Chris Pine is the right. Spider-Man gets killed.
Yeah, he says you won't know. You just have to take a leap of faith.
That honesty was so refreshing.
When we're watching these superhero films, often there is a theme that's sometimes verbalized that is the callback, like the theme that kind of is the thread that's the emotional strength of the character. For Batman Begins, it's always, you know, Alfred saying and Batman's and Bruce Wayne's parents saying, "What happens when you fall down? You pick yourself back up." And that is throughout the film. Here, there are a couple months. There's definitely the leap of faith. And then it's also literally Spider-Man always bounces back up.
He gets up.
And that calls back to the classic Spider-Man comic book where he is piled underneath the pile of rubble.
The Steve Ditko image.
And he, against all odds, sheer strength, willpower, pushes and breaks up. And they alluded to that in Spider-Man Homecoming with Tom Holland's character being underneath the rubble when the Vulture collapsed the building.
You're saying Spider-Man in general, not Miles Morales in particular.
Yes. Okay. But I do love that leap of faith.
Let's talk about that then, because that's what happens in the end of the movie. Like, he gets hit. He gets the death punch that dead Spider-Man got, and yet Miles Morales survives it, and he stands up.
Yes.
Why?
He's younger, more spry. He has, you know, shocking powers. Maybe it was a better spider that bit him.
All right.
All comic book logic.
There was a way that the Chris Pine Spider-Man, you could see he was tired. He says he's tired.
Yeah.
And I think that has something to do with that. I think that the whole idea of Miles Morales coming in was to freshen up Spider-Man as a character. Two other things I want to call out. I mean, how good was it to see Stan Lee in role?
And not like a super short, quippy quip. It was like a nice little scene.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. That was
well,
nice.
I teared up there.
Yeah, because this is released just weeks after Stan Lee's passing.
And has a dedication to him at the end of the movie.
Dedication.
Him and Steve Ditko.
Long hard for the quote they would use for Stan Lee at the end for his dedication. But the creators of the film said, the writers of the film said that for Stanley's cameo, they wanted it to have some significance, and the significance here isn't just that he's a comic shop owner, but he gives Miles Morales the mask. He gives him his mask, Spider-Man mask.
He sells him his mask.
Yeah, he sells him his mask, but he hands him the mask, which, you know, there's a bit of comedy in that element, but the line he says always ends up fitting eventually has significance. You know, you can read it multiple ways.
What do you mean?
You know, Miles Morales doesn't know if it'll fit.
Yep.
And then Stanley says it ends up, you know, you grow into it.
I like that idea, but what's the other way you could see it?
Well, you grow into it physically, and also you grow into it as, like, your character grows into it.
Oh, I like that.
And it fits you as your character.
Which also happens eventually.
Exactly.
I like that.
Exactly. There's, of course, a whole bevy of other spider heroes in this film. There's Spider-Gwen, who's an alternate universe Spider-Man, hugely popular in the comics.
Did you know that she was Spider-Gwen when you saw her in the classroom?
I did.
You both knew that? Okay, cool. Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of things for fans of comics. Knowing that Uncle Aaron was the Prowler, that's a bit that works as a bit of tension for both people who do know and don't know. Uh-huh. I assume for you who didn't know, did you predict that he was the Prowler?
It didn't surprise me. And you know what? I knew before he took his mask off.
Mm. When he was in the apartment.
Yes. I knew then that it was Uncle Aaron. They gave it away with just the facial structure. It was all
That's
there.
Nice. That's good.
It was all there.
I didn't actually expect him to, like, I expected him to be the bad guy. I knew the Prowler thing. I didn't expect, like, the Prowler and Kingpin until we saw the Prowler with Kingpin, right?
Yeah. I mean, Prowler is an essential part of Miles Morales' Spider-Man because he is the dark side, but he also is the Ben Parker. He is the death that, you know, that galvanizes and becomes the emotional core.
Part of the origin story.
The origin story.
Yeah.
And it's not just someone that is pure of character, as you had in Ben Parker, but someone that is in the gray area. There is no black and white. He is a villain. He is a super villain, but he is the one that pushed Miles Morales to be true to himself while still also living the expectations that other people have put before him. I also love that Spider-Gwen, the first appearance, is in the room, right, when he's late to the class, and he makes that joke about relativity of being here early, mm-hmm. and that totally is double entendre once you realize that Spider-Gwen is the one that's here early because she got thrown 1 week into the past.
Oh, that's funny. That's
right? And that's why she laughs at the joke.
Can we talk about the robot girl? Because she's freaking cool.
Yeah, I actually don't know too much about Spider-Penny.
Spider-Penny?
But from what I understand, you know, Japanese girl in the future with a robot, and she doesn't have spider powers. There is a mutant spider inside the robot that is her best friend.
I don't know. She just looks like D.Va from
Overwatch.
Overwatch to me. I think a lot of people are just going to assume that they ripped that off. But did she exist in the comics?
Yeah, in a version of the comics.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Spider-Noir. As well, there was actually a video game called Spider-Man Shattered Dimensions, I believe back in 2012, that had both Spider-Man, Ultimate Spider-Man, Spider-Man Noir, and Spider-Man 2099.
Do you know who voiced Spider-Man Noir?
It's Nick Cage.
How about that, man? That was funny. You didn't know that going in either.
I did know that going in.
You knew that one?
I knew that one.
How about that?
I knew that one going in, although you can immediately recognize it. He talks in 30s lingo.
Yeah.
And apparently they give some creative freedom to the voice actors because they don't animate. They're wearing masks, so you can say whatever you want, right? That's one of the benefits of not having to animate their faces. And they did some ad-libbing, and Nick Cage was apparently very inappropriate. There are some things they had to just cut out. They could not let him say as Spider-Man in a rated PG-13 movie. Rated PG movie. Is it really PG?
It's kind
of intense.
Yeah,
it's scare and
the killing. Absolutely.
Yeah, there's multiple deaths. John Mulaney as Spider-Ham. Such good voice casting. He's perfect for it.
There was not enough of him in this movie. Like, that was my only complaint, is I wanted more of that. That was very interesting.
My kid's not going to understand Looney Tunes just growing up like this, but the payoff.
Spider-Ham, every time, a bit joke, right?
At the end?
But, like, the joke with the hammer, he gives the hammer and says, you can put this in your pocket.
Yeah, it's funny.
Oh, and then it's perfect.
Roger Rabbit.
Great writing. And, of course, the Jake Johnson Spider-Man. So the veteran, gray-haired, done it for 22 years Spider-Man. Again, what a different take. Filled with comedy. I loved it. Mm-hmm. So the theory is that this Spider-Man is supposed to be the 616 Spider-Man.
Oh.
That's the theory. And that's due to...
What do you mean, this Spider-Man?
616 is the main...
The Jake Johnson, the older Spider-Man. That's supposed to be the Spider-Man from the comic books.
Oh, the fat one?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't think it matters. Because this movie isn't about what is the true the theme of the movie is you can anyone can be Spider-Man. Even you can be Spider-Man. And it really is Miles Morales' story, but like I think as a device, this older Spider-Man just comic relief.
Imperfect mentor. I always love those.
Yeah.
I think that always makes sense. Can we talk about one last thing though?
Ooh, hit me.
Oh, God, the end credit scene.
Okay. All right. Well, there's Is it two end credits?
Well, what about Doc Ock? Did you guys see that coming?
I did not.
I did not see that coming.
That was great.
At all.
Catherine
all
right. Hahn.
All right.
Liv.
Good.
Liv Octavius.
Yeah, that was good.
Loved it. That was great. And the animation for the tentacles and
so good. When she put up her hair, how good that looked with the.
Yeah, I love the Aunt May line. Oh, it's Liv again.
Madam Web.
I don't think they were going for it, but in my head, that's my headcanon. Right.
Lily Tomlin.
For was
for
Aunt May.
Yeah, Aunt May.
She's in the
good.
Comics here is, or in this movie here is like Q. She made
all those suits and stuff. Yeah, that was
really
cool.
Neat. And if you blink, you'll miss it. But there are suits from the Spider-Man game, the Insomniac games count this year. They have that suit, which is a Doc Ock suit
in the chamber.
In the chamber
of all the suits.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
cool. There's one there.
Is there really a suit with a cape on it in the comic books?
I don't recall one.
So. Okay, just wanted to fact check that one.
Batman is the other character that has like weird personas and throughout the history of Batman has like crazy outfits and different interpretations of Batman that they could have done like a Batman verse. Any other questions from you, Jeremy?
Well, from my son, yeah, back to Kishore's next topic. I need to understand the post-credit sequence, please.
Was there a mid-credits or a mid-end post?
No, I mean, the only thing was the dedication to Stan Lee and Steve Ditko. I mean, forget about like us explaining it for a second.
Oh, okay.
I did not see that coming. That was one of the funniest things I've ever seen. I don't know how it's just not across the entire internet, just dominating it.
Is it funny because you understand it, or is it funny?
So there are two
it's
parts.
It's funny because the internet
part. So the post-credit scene, one is the meme.
Yeah.
And the meme is from the 1967 Spider-Man cartoon.
Yeah.
You have the two Spider-Man pointing at each other,
uh-huh.
which is an internet meme now. You know, it's been used for as a meme to reference clones in movies.
But that is an actual frame from an old comic. Like, that happens?
From a TV show.
From the Spider-Man TV show, that happened?
Not those two exact characters.
Oh, okay.
But two, actually, I'll pull this up for you.
It's a Spider-Man pointing at a same-looking Spider-Man. And that's the internet meme as being like,
Don't point at me. Yeah.
Right here, this is a frame.
Yeah.
Spider-Man pointing at Spider-Man with NYPD in the back in the van is the meme.
That's interesting.
And so they call on that meme.
That's interesting.
So good.
Which is, I think, the joke when people saw that this movie was going to be about multiple Spider-Man. People were already making the joke. And so this is a self-awareness of that joke. But then the character that they put in as one of the Spider-Man.
Yeah. Is he evil? Is he evil?
No.
He's not evil?
No.
He looks a little evil.
He looks menacing. It's Spider-Man 2099.
Yeah, and his universe is rough.
What are you so talking
about? In the 90s,
okay.
Before the Ultimate Universe, Marvel did an event series called 2099 where they had imagine the future. What would this Marvel universe look like, you know, 100 years from now, over 100 years from now, in the year 2099? All the heroes would be maybe dead. Maybe Wolverine's still alive because he lives forever.
Mm-hmm.
But Spider-Man is not Peter Parker. It's a guy named
Miguel O'Hara, I think.
And he is injected with, I believe, a serum that gets him addicted to this future drug. And then he needs to combine his DNA with spider genomes to try to fight that addiction while also fighting a corrupt kingpin of the future. And he actually has like spider teeth. He has like sharp teeth underneath. He's hulking persona. The costume looks exactly as you saw in that end credit sequence.
Menacing.
Very menacing.
And who's the woman with him?
That's like his cue. It looks different than how she appeared in the comics, but it's like his sidekick, partner in crime thing. I didn't expect 2099 to be here at all.
No, it was awesome.
Well, neither did I, Norm. Did they imply that that's how the next movie is going to pick up?
No.
Okay.
No way.
All right.
I'll show you... A 2099, Spider-Man 2099 was, and this is like very 90s style comics. Like, it does not look.
I don't care for it. It looks like.
It's very, here, Gus. Look at this cover.
Looks like a new Transformers movie or something.
Look at this. That's how it was drawn back when it was first released.
No thanks.
Yeah. It's very aggressive.
That's good stuff. And shout out to the voice acting, man. The voice acting in this movie is one of the best. In cartoons. I mean, the dad I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm a dad.
The dad's an Oscar winner.
He's good. He's
it's
good.
It's a what's the name? blah, 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 blah.
That's a copy.
Say I love you. I've said that to my son.
You need a megaphone.
Yeah.
That's good stuff.
In a year that we've already had, and I think we turned off the spoiler light now. We've gone post-spoilers. But in a year where we had Black Panther, which is a movie about identity and representation, and it has definite self-awareness. You know, I've talked about this on other podcasts.
Yeah.
One of the most powerful moments in Black Panther is the final scene. Do you remember
When
they go back to Oakland, but specifically the last line of the film, it turns on its head the superhero trope of who are you? You know, if you're talking about Batman, you know, the criminal saying who are you and I'm Batman, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is more about Batman revealing itself to the world. But in Black Panther, the kid in Oakland looking up to Black Panther and saying who are you is more powerful as a reflection on that kid and who that kid sees in front of him and in himself. So in a year where we have that, this movie feels like it's takes that those ideas and many of those themes to a whole nother level, to a point where I think I like this more than Black Panther. And I think it makes a case for not letting Marvel and Disney get control of everything. The creative freedom that
this
folks
is not
had.
The only case for that.
Right, right. But this makes a strong case.
You're saying Aquaman is promising?
No, I'm not saying that.
Oh.
And in a year that we had already a great Spider-Man narrative, you know, this movie unfortunately makes me less interested in Spider-Man Far From Home, the MCU Spider-Man film, because that just feels like
there's room for multiple spider people in your heart, Norm.
I'm sure it'll be a fine film. I'm sure I'll like it, but the movie I want to see is Into the Spider-Verse 2. And I want to see the spinoffs.
Well,
announced.
You know, you never forget your first time. I wonder if Spider-Verse 2 is going to be just as impactful because you'll know what to expect now.
I think if they have the same creative talent behind it, I mean,
we know how this is going to go. Next one's going to be great. Third one's going to be horrible.
Oh, is that how it goes?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's how it goes.
With Spider-Man films?
Yeah.
They never got to the third one with Andrew Garfield. And it was just the second one, which I rewatched recently, and I liked it a lot more. When I first watched it,
Sony's trying to make sure that other people can't make films that look like this, and we'll talk more about that, I think, in pop culture.
Are we not on pop culture yet? Oh my goodness, let's get to it.
Yeah, we got
to
fly through.
Pop culture. Okay. Is there anything going on aside from Spider-Man in pop culture? Where do we want to go? Let's talk about Spider-Man.
Okay.
Sony, the way they animated this film, and I can't wait if there's a Cinefex where they'll dive into the animation technologies. But Sony actually is trying to patent some of the animation techniques and technologies that went into the Spider-Verse.
They said that they took the standard 3D editing pipeline and just jettisoned most of the, you know, tried and true techniques. Most of the technologies that people pay a lot of money to license, they didn't use, which is an expensive gamble. But it paid off in a film that looks totally unique.
Yeah.
Like they talked about how they edit on twos, which is they do like a 12 frame a second frame per second animation technique on top of a 24 frame per second.
They're combining
background.
Different frame rates.
Exactly.
So the characters, because when you're talking about the old Disney style of animation, like you can have backgrounds, background plates that mm-hmm. look a certain way and foreground plates and character plates that look a certain way. But yeah, some characters and some of the action, it's almost like ramping up the shutter speed for some of this stuff, which makes some of the action in the Marvel movies look extra fast. But they did that so the characters kind of jump across the screen. And subconsciously, your brain reads it differently.
I don't know if I get why they're filing the patent. It's totally defensible. Still don't wish that this is the way it would go. Because you don't see this with, like, directors filing patents on their style in normal motion films.
We'll see if
that's
this,
not the right way.
I don't
to
know
say
if
that.
This is as passable as you say. We'll see what the courts say. Or I don't know. I guess you can get patents for anything, and then it has to hold up in court.
Right, right. And it's unclear exactly which part of this process they're patenting. I don't think they can patent the idea of taking frames from the rendered pipeline and then doing hand-drawn animation on top. Like, that's...
Yeah. But if they did some algorithmic, like, predictions of next frames, that kind of stuff, maybe they can protect that.
Yeah, a lot of technology goes into this stuff, and kudos to the studio in, I believe, Vancouver that worked on this. Talking about animation, mm-hmm. and we got two stories related to Pixar. Pixar's next movie, or is it their new movie, not necessarily their next movie.
I think this comes out after Toy Story 4.
So Toy Story 4, we've seen a teaser for, looking forward to it, but post-Toy Story 4, their next film, their film about that will be called Onward.
Yeah.
And they gave a very short synopsis.
Well, yeah, it follows a couple of teenage elf brothers on a quest to find out if there's still magic left in the world.
And it stars Spider-Man and Star-Lord.
Yeah, and Julia Louis-Dreyfus in her second Pixar role. She was also in A Bug's Life.
Oh.
Wow.
Right, wasn't she?
Deep cut.
Yeah, yeah. What's the least remembered Pixar film?
Should be Cars 3.
Oh, no, it's that dinosaur one.
Or Cars 2.
Good Dinosaur?
Yeah. Oh, I like The Good Dinosaur, though. Cars 2 was bad.
Cars 2? I liked Cars 2. It was just totally different.
No, that's like Spy Car?
No, right? it was like 007.
It was bad.
Revisit it. See if you like it. Cars 3, however, boring.
Cars 3 was
a toss-up between Good Dinosaur and Brave.
Good Dinosaur and Brave both had good stories. It just didn't live up to like the Pixar.
We watched Brave this year, and it holds up. It's better than you remember.
Both of those hold up. Yeah. Better than remember.
But... Good Dinosaur? I don't know about that. Oh. I don't know.
Oh. Sorry, yeah. Pete-san. All right. Speaking of other Pixar things that do hold up, their shorts also hold up. And previously, you could only get their shorts by watching it on Netflix or buying the collected DVD sets. Mm-hmm. But in celebration of their most recent short that was attached to Incredibles 2 being nominated, put on the shortlist for the Academy Awards.
Bow.
It is now viewable on YouTube. And if you haven't seen this, if for some reason you didn't watch Incredibles 2 in the theater or rent or buy the DVD or Blu-ray, go check out Bow. For me, it's probably the most relatable.
No way. Oh, for you. Sorry.
Sanjay Super Team.
Yeah, Sanjay Super Team is my relatable one.
Yeah, well, all we need is Jeremy to find what's your most relatable Pixar short? Jerry's Game.
That one with the puffin? What was that one?
For the Birds?
I really like For the Birds. I don't know. I'd have to think about that. That's an important question.
Bounden?
No, I didn't dig in the Bounded. I mean, obviously, Luxo Jr. is always special to me, but I don't know.
They've done a lot. I think they're...
Oh, yeah.
They're shorts. Oh, Night and Day?
I mean, you're talking about personal relating?
Yeah.
No. Oh, yeah, I love... Night and Day is my favorite, easily. That is a 3D masterpiece. That should be studied in art school. Because
it should be. That is the best
3D short ever made.
They should patent the technique used for Night and Day. What was the one? Piper. Piper?
Piper's great.
Piper was more of a feat of engineering to me.
Mm. I don't know. Let me get back to you on that.
Oh, you know what it's going to be?
What?
It's the one in the clouds with the birds with the storks.
Yeah, I didn't like that one.
You didn't like that one?
Mm-mm.
Okay, we'll let you think on it. We'll talk about it in the new year.
What's the one, like Red's Dream? No, that's the unicycle one. What's the one that led to Toy Story, you know, where the snowman...
Tinker Toy?
Tintoy?
Tintoy.
Yeah, maybe that one. Oh. I like that one. That's good.
There are a lot that just... I don't remember.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of them.
Oh, I forgot about Jerry's Game.
That's their first Oscar-winning one.
Yeah, I forgot about that one.
Hey, speaking of the new year,
okay.
Also coming the new year, Star Trek Discovery.
I can't believe that this hasn't come out yet. Like, wasn't it a while ago that season one ended?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like a reasonable amount of time, though.
It's been a reasonable amount of time?
It's not Game of Thrones length of time since the previous season.
I mean, this looks good.
It does. There is a new behind-the-scenes trailer talking about how they have filmed this new season. Of course, it features minor spoilers. I'm just going to say it features the Enterprise, the Discovery take on the Enterprise with Captain Pike.
Yeah.
And
Spock.
and a Spock. They've recast Spock. Spock, I think, is probably the core of the mystery in this new season. The Klingons are redesigned.
There's a great line in the trailer where, is it Pike? Somebody asks Spock, is that a smile I see on your face? Mm. And he says, yes, it is.
No.
What?
No, it isn't. It's just my beard.
That's great.
People have already scrutinized the details, the background shots in the production design for this trailer, and look at the schematics of the Enterprise, and have said it has met the standards of the schematics as what we know is canon.
I actually think it looks too teched out.
That's great.
I mean, it was inevitable, right? It was the retelling of that era, the TOS era. You know, the thing we're all looking forward to. We wanted to get season two out of the way. I'm sure we'll enjoy it. But we're just waiting for the end of 2019.
You know,
Picard show.
Oh, dude, is that coming out next year for sure?
That's the rumor.
I'll bring it. You know, speaking of de-technifying, do you know what's got 93% on Rotten Tomatoes right now?
You know, I saw the commercial for it over the weekend. It was 97% was what Paramount was touting.
Bumblebee.
What? Highest rated Transformer film. You know, it turns out if you just don't let Michael Bay direct a Transformer film.
It's got to be lowest budget, too, because they're aiming for a younger audience.
Are you sure about that?
Yeah.
PG-13?
Oh, yeah. This is a kids movie. Hmm. Is it PG-13? I mean, I imagine the others are PG-13 too. But right. They are definitely skewing young with their demographic. It just feels like that.
But it's an 80s film.
But it's like, it's my Transformers.
That's right.
The Transformers, like Bumblebee is a Volkswagen Beetle, as he should. And Optimus looks like he's supposed to.
I don't believe these reviews. Like, I'm in denial. I think I'm in such like PTSD from all of these horrible Transformers movies that I don't believe these numbers.
But look, this takes place in San Francisco.
Oh, they're going to destroy the bridge, aren't they?
How do they get around the fact, because this is in the same universe as the Michael Bay, the Shia LaBeouf Transformers films.
Is it?
And this is supposed to explain how Bumblebee ends up in that
form.
And the Camaro. And so the world at that point is not aware of Transformers. And so it's not going to be, I think from what I've read, it's not a massive number of robots.
Yeah.
I think there is some Cybertron footage where you see in the trailers. For fans of the original designs, this may be holding a little more true.
I'm just glad to see my Transformers.
It's going to be a competitive weekend. Coming out this weekend, Bumblebee, you got Aquaman, and you got Mary Poppins Returns.
Bring the toys. I want the Bumblebee toy.
So much. And we also have a first look now at the live-action remake of Aladdin. I think this is going to be attached probably to Mary Poppins as that comes out this weekend.
Oh, the trailer?
The trailer.
Because we don't have a trailer yet.
No, we just have images. Entertainment Weekly has the first photos of Aladdin, Jasmine, and Will Smith as the genie.
That Will Smith.
The movie superstar Will Smith, bad boy Will Smith, Fresh Prince Will Smith as the genie. I'm very, very conflicted.
About his hair?
About his look, period.
Jasmine and Aladdin look fine.
They look okay.
Yeah, they look fine. That's the definition of fine.
They do not look inspired to me. And maybe part of the problem, I mean, one, of course, it's tough to try to imitate or even top Robin Williams' genie. You can never do that.
No. Right?
So people are wondering, one, would he be blue? Would he be blue, period? And two, would he be CG? And I think in an Entertainment Weekly story, Will Smith has addressed that fact that at some point he will be CG, and at some point they will have him blue.
Really?
But for the vast majority of the film, he will look like a shaved-headed Will Smith with this ponytail, I guess you can call it, and a beard.
A weird goatee.
Now, for Disney obsessives.
Oh, yeah.
They already have a live action of Aladdin because Aladdin has been a successful Broadway musical.
Yeah.
And the take on Genie in that musical, very flamboyant, great songs. And
clearly inspired by Robin Williams, like almost doing an enactment of Robin Williams.
No, I don't think so.
The one that they show at Disneyland is very much that way, and I assume that it's the same.
No.
It's not the same?
It's not the same.
Okay.
Because the Broadway Genie definitely has a flamboyance that the Robin Williams one.
Okay, I like to hear. I'm glad to hear that.
And has a body type, a larger dude, and is hilarious and really charming. And now this, you know, Will Smith has to kind of replace that as well.
I mean, he has to help create a whole new world.
I don't get it. You know, sometimes the coolest boosted board mod is a magic carpet on top of the boosted board.
Yeah, I've seen people do that.
That's really well done.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of other things that you may have seen on YouTube this week, two videos I want to talk about. And the first, as both of you are parents to young children, mm-hmm. I'm definitely interested in hearing your opinion. Jimmy Kimmel has issued a challenge for parents. Now, he's done this before with Halloween candy.
Yeah.
He has a thing where he asks parents to film videos where they tell their kids that they've eaten all their Halloween candy the day after Halloween. The kids usually break down. It's quite sad. But for some reason, you know, it's also, you know, I can't deny there's a comedy to it.
Mm-hmm.
He's now asking parents to film themselves turning off television screens while their kids are playing Fortnite. And the reactions are universally insane. The kids go nuts.
Well, when scientists do this kind of experiment, I think it's called a dick move.
Technically, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's mean.
It is mean. It's mean when you take away the candy from the children.
Well, yes, but this is like real-time mean. this is like you're in the middle of something. Everybody can relate to this. Imagine watching a movie or TV show and having it turned off in the middle of an important moment.
Now, the question is, in that moment, how do you react? Are you pissed off? Are you sad? Do you lash out? Some of these kids, the degree to which they react surprised me.
You know he must have gotten thousands of submissions.
And this is the cream of the crop.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. Like, there's actually physical violence that ensues. And, like,
my goodness.
Real, like, R-rated language from little kids.
Yeah, someone's like, did Fortnite sponsor this? Like, no, this doesn't make Fortnite look good at all.
Yeah, no, it definitely...
You know what else doesn't make Fortnite look good? Playing Fortnite. That sucks.
This is not reflect on Fortnite at all. This is how anybody reacts when you turn their video game off.
This is not anybody. This is a different time. A different generation.
Nope. I would have done this. If
resorted to physical violence?
No, I wouldn't have done that. But I would have flipped out. I would have said, what are you doing? Stop it. Turn it back on.
I kind of agree. I think this is a lot more hype than substance.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other video that popped up on YouTube, and we're taking this from our tech section, that does live up to the hype. This is amazing. This is ex-NASA engineer. Who runs a YouTube channel, does a lot of electronics and 3D printing projects. But Mark
Rober.
Rober.
Haven't you met Mark? He lives up here.
I've never met Mark.
He's local?
Yeah, he's local. We've been at things where he's been in the same room as us.
Why can't we be friends with him?
We should be friends
there
with him.
There are parts of the Tested family that already are.
Oh, wow.
So,
well, he has an amazing video that... perfect timing. What a perfect...
Why is this perfect timing?
Because of Christmas. Because people are getting packages delivered now.
And stolen?
And stolen.
Yeah.
In quantity now. But he took upon himself to design a...
Well, let's start out. He had a package stolen.
Yes.
He had video footage from his porch of the package being stolen. Probably got the faces of the criminals. Turned it over to the police. And the police said, we have bigger fish to fry. Not going to help you.
That's sad.
Yeah, that's the way that it goes in many places. Actually, I had the opposite experience. My neighborhood, we actually just caught a thief doing it.
Oh, my God. Tell us about this.
Well, it's just what you think. We have video footage of my neighbor's package being stolen.
From a camera, from like security cam footage?
She had security camera footage of her front porch, of the package, and the lady's face. And I had security camera footage of her car and license plate. So we combined forces and reported it to the police, and the police, like, apprehended her. They went and they arrested her, went inside her house, found out that she is a serial package thief, and they returned a bunch of items.
Oh, my gosh.
So
that's brazen.
So that's...
It is a problem.
Doesn't always happen the way that it goes down for this guy, but it does.
So Jeremy and I were talking about this earlier. I think this video does something really well. It walks this fine line in this really... kind of sensitive area. He obviously, Mark, touches upon something that a lot of people can relate to, package theft. And a lot of people were sort of out for mob justice. If you look at the YouTube comments, like, why did you blur out the images of the people? Like, name them and shame them. And I think that's like one of those difficult places where you can invite certain behavior based on this design that would not be good. And you might dig into stories that reveal a more difficult life for these people that are actually committing these thefts than you might want to find at the surface. So I think he manages to walk this line carefully where there's a sense of justice, but not vengeance.
Okay. Yeah, fine.
And presumably, I mean, has he come out to say whether he's reported these people and these people have faced legal consequences versus just the mob justice?
Not. Given that he reported the initial thief and there was no legal consequence, I bet he has lost faith that there would be any consequence for any further reports. Let's briefly explain what he did. Mm-hmm. He built a contraption that activated. Well, first of all, it was GPS enabled. So when it left his porch,
a geofence,
it turned on.
Yes.
And the device was activated.
Custom board, too, for that, which is awesome.
Lots of custom 3D printing and board work. When they lift the top off this box,
which looked like a Apple HomePod box.
Yeah. Two leaf switches are thrown, and it starts this blender action, which throws glitter all over, in different cases, the car or the bed or wherever the criminal is.
Ooh,
just with basic centrifugal forces. And, brilliant.
And then it automatically sprays fart spray every 10 seconds into the room.
30 seconds, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, which you can get in an aerosol can, tiny aerosol can, that he just attached to a cam system.
Little thing that triggers it. And then the whole thing is recorded by four cell phones that are hidden inside this 3D printed blender with holes cut out so that the whole thing is filmed every angle and then live up uploaded to the cloud in case he can't retrieve it back. However, he always retrieves it because as soon as the fart spray turns on, they throw it out the window.
Here's what I love. I love the people. One, the reactions are fantastic, and those people deserve everything. That they deserve to have glitter that they'll never be able to clean out of their car in mass. But everyone throws away the box and the top of the box. They throw away every part of it.
That's right.
They don't want anything to do with
it. If they only knew there were four cell phones in there, they would have kept it. But like, how many criminals are in this video? At least five, six?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, dead over 6 months, and I mean, it probably can't work again. But what a brilliant idea! And glitter, that's the perfect amount of punishment.
If you don't subscribe to Mark's channel, you should. He does amazing experiments. He over engineers a lot of different systems. His dartboard one is quite famous, where he basically designs a dartboard with image recognition so that anytime you throw a dart, it hits bullseye because the dartboard moves.
It's clever. He said he also did work for NASA.
Yeah, he used to work on JPL, and he worked on some components that are in a rover on Mars right now, in Curiosity. I like his fluidized bed video with the hot tub using sand. That was pretty great. About pumping air through it. I thought it was a kind of brilliant set of physics. And we use some of his videos in our annual egg drop at school. Mark is a really, really, really nice guy, too. Great science YouTuber.
That's great. And congratulations to him. Huge success on that video. It's fun to watch. And hey, all these package thieves, hope you burn.
Ouch.
I actually have a lot. I think this is like a one of those threads I don't think you want to pull too hard on. Like, I totally hear you about the package thieves.
There is no excuse.
I'm sure. Yeah, it's still theft. I'm not making an excuse. I'm telling you that if you pull on those stories too hard, some stories that you don't want to emerge will emerge.
All right. I watched the video. Watching a lot of Netflix these days, and I watched this documentary called The American Meme.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I turned it on because I thought it would be about meme culture.
Where'd you find this?
Netflix. Okay. Netflix original documentary. And I thought it'd be about the culture of memes and how people and how everything's a remix and how fast it takes to create something and maybe like where Tezan Day is right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about that at all.
What's it about?
The title's just a play on the American Dream, but it's about celebrity influencer culture. And these and people who share their entire lives online and build these incredible followings and have these personas to the point where watching this, I realized I knew none of these people. I'd heard of DJ Khaled, but I didn't know anything about him. I'm not a Snapchat user. I felt old watching this documentary.
Mm-hmm.
The most relatable thing about this documentary was Paris Hilton, because she's a big part of it. And, you know, they credit her as being the first person to really start sharing all of their day-to-day online and building this brand, you know, a precursor to what the Kardashians do and what internet personas like the Fat Jewish does on Instagram. And I found it utterly fascinating, definitely terrifying, because there are people who live, like they want, I mean, I see this in kids today, right? They want to grow up. And what do they want to be? Is they want to be an influencer / internet personality.
Yeah.
And
I can attest to that.
And this is, and this is taking that to an extreme, because these are people with tens of millions of followers, right? Millions and millions of followers. And what I guess this documentary doesn't do is go back and look at, you know, the scary part isn't the dozen or so people with tens of millions of followers that are these top-end influencers, but what the world looks like when you have tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people with thousands of followers. You know, the long tail of internet celebrity and internet influencer, and that is the realistically the world we're getting toward, we're building toward.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
you want that documentary?
Yeah, I do want that documentary.
That's like a story about us. Yeah, what are you talking about?
You'd be
like,
in it, right?
Well, like, people we know for sure.
You want to be interviewed?
No, I want to see from a critical eye, from researcher's eye, what this means for society.
Yeah.
Right? And at the end of the documentary, it ends on Paris Hilton.
Mm-hmm.
And it ends with her talking about how she feels like having so much of her life online, some of which she didn't want online, and some which she willingly puts online to build her brand,
mm-hmm.
making millions and millions of dollars. But she feels like one of the costs of this is of course, losing control of her image. And to recapture that control of her image, one of the projects that she's working on is to digitize herself
okay.
with photogrammetry and to build a VR landscape where she has her own avatar and people can interact with her avatar and she has control. And this just made me think about that movie, The Congress, which was Robin Wright Penn in a fictionalized version of herself where she sold her image to a corporation, to a movie studio, her image as she was, as she appeared, you know, in her late 30s, and what that means to sell your image. And I thought that was, that's the world where we may be going to.
Oh my goodness.
It's,
you know what, Norm? I'm not going to watch this.
You shouldn't watch it. You shouldn't watch it. It's not for kids.
All right.
It will make you feel sad.
It doesn't sound like it's for adults either.
It would just make you feel sad and old. It made me feel, as I was holding my crying child.
That's my default state.
Feeling sad and old.
Do we need this David Harbour?
Yeah.
Story? What's this?
Hellboy. The first trailer for Hellboy is out. This is the Hellboy, I guess we can call it a reboot.
It's weird to talk about Hellboy without Adam around as like the major Hellboy fan of The Office. I like the new lens on Hellboy. I think it was time for Guillermo to sort of let go. There's aspects of this that look good, like some of the monsters I thought were interesting. I'm not convinced about David Harbour's take yet.
Is there really
more comical? Yeah, there's a full trailer.
Where's the trailer? Is it play here sometime?
No, let me give you a link.
Oh, it's not. It's not at the show notes link. Okay.
Yeah, I mean,
so here's my fear. There's of course the every actor has their right to bring their own take to the character, right? No one's asking David Harbour to do an imitation of what Ron Perlman did in the first two Hellboy films. Of course, there's the Mike Mignola comic books, and as long as they capture the voice of that Hellboy, which is a little jovial, sarcastic, there's going to be some comedy mixed with action. That's what Hellboy has been about in the comics. What I'm afraid this film, and it's way too early to sell because it's only one trailer, what I'm afraid the film will not do is show beauty in its monsters, because that's what Guillermo brought to not only the Hellboy films, but most of his films show. He's comfortable not only designing these beautiful and creative and fascinating and striking monsters, but to bring out the beauty and the humanity in those monsters and not just portray them as monsters.
I think they also have to walk a fine line with Hellboy himself and not go too comedic, but still bringing some levity, some irreverence to that character.
Correct. You guys are much bigger Hellboy fans than I was. My impression of the films were that they were never breakout successes like we've seen in the recent
past. They were
past
cult hits, though.
With Marvel.
Total cult hits.
Sure. But what was their total revenue, like their total return on? I mean, it couldn't have been anything like the Marvel films.
Oh, no.
Right?
No.
So I'm kind of thinking that after this kind of success in superhero films, they want more. And so they're trying to make something that has more mass market appeal.
Yeah.
Can that be done? And if it can, doesn't it have to be substantially different than the last films?
No, then just you don't need to make a super expensive giant Hellboy movie. You can make the small Hellboy movie. All you need is good makeup, good prosthetics.
Yeah.
And you can tell an intimate creature story without having him to fight these giant monsters.
This film was clearly made with a big budget. Mm-hmm. I don't think that they are willing to take a gamble in making a small film.
Yeah, and the first film made its money back, right? It costs, I believe, $80 million to make, and it made $76 million in the U.S. and overseas. It had a total $84 million overseas, so it made basically all of its money back, $160 million, which is not a blockbuster film.
Yeah,
right. If it made $100 million in the U.S., then maybe a different story. But I'm wondering who their audience is. Is their audience the people who read the comic books, or is their audience, if they're counting on the people who liked the first film to want to come back for this film, I think they're going to have to go work a little harder.
My whole point is they want a whole new audience.
Right. So if they want a whole new audience.
If they lose that entire original audience, right, but get 10 times the number of people who are a different audience, they'll take it.
Of course. Then is Hellboy the right character to do that with?
Yeah, I don't know.
Right? At that point, is Hellboy a character ripe for that kind of mass market appeal? It's for the market analysts and the researchers to tell us, the pollsters to tell us. All right. A few bits of tech news this week. We're not going to talk about the crazy Facebook stuff.
Okay.
They may be giving your private information out to Spotify and their other partners. It's kind of scary. Still being figured out.
Okay.
Virgin Galactic.
Still
spaceship
doing it,
too.
Huh?
Yeah.
How about that?
Of course. Yeah, people have bought their tickets already.
It's a darn good-looking spaceship.
Well, it has reached technically space for the first time in its most recent test.
What does technically space mean, Kishore?
This is a weird thing. There's different definitions of where space begins. And so some say that Virgin Galactic actually reached that elevation off the surface that was technically space. Others say that it's farther. So
that the boundary is farther, 62
yeah.
miles or 50 miles.
Exactly.
At that point, technically, is it that much harder to get that extra 12 miles?
I mean, the hard part is to get into orbit,
yeah.
Right? So, I mean, at that point, you're really dealing with, the extra trajectory and momentum to spin you into orbit. So it's not about sort of just like straight elevation at that point. But I mean, it went exactly where it was designed to go. So whether it's the edge of space or not, I don't think matters. You see the curvature of the Earth. You're, for all intents and purposes, for people that are buying tickets on this thing, you're in space.
You get some weightlessness.
Yeah.
That's cool. The ISS, by comparison, is 250 miles above the Earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's still very close.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Compared to going to someplace like the moon.
You can see it.
Yeah, totally. With the naked eye.
Yeah.
We talked in the past weeks about alternatives to Steam, and of course, one alternative that's building up the store is Discord. Discord is going to even beat Epic with their developer revenue split.
Holy cow.
With a 90-10 split. They're only going to take 10% of the cost to do this distribution. I guess they need to be aggressive if they feel like they want to build a storefront.
But now Discord launched their store a while ago. Did they just announce a change in their revenue model, their revenue split?
I'm not sure.
Because I thought it was membership-based, first of all. It was like a curated set of games.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to change it. Yeah. Okay. They've make this change in 2019. I don't know if it's going to be backdated, though, if they're going to give out more money. But they also said they'll try to go lower than 10% if they can discover efficiencies in their operating costs.
Mm.
I mean, that's aggressive. Well, I guess the question is, would you at that point lower prices and just keep prices low, or would you just incentivize, are you going to incentivize developers or are you going to incentivize consumers? Because I think more powerful to incentivize consumers.
I don't know. You got to let the developers control the price point, though, don't you think?
But you would work with developers.
Yeah.
Right? You'd say, we're going to institute the policy as opposed to 30%, we're going to do 10%. Why don't we start off with all games 15% off for launch week?
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to make same amount of money or more money.
Yeah.
But you're going to get a lot more customers.
I think what we're going to end up seeing are a lot of games launching on the Epic Store and probably Discord and then moving to Steam once the initial, you know, cash has been made. That's what I would imagine.
That's a big shift in users.
Timed exclusivity.
Where users are going to live.
Yeah, but it's, you know, indie devs got to make their money. I don't blame them.
Yep. With terms of cell phone tech, you know, emerging technologies, one next big one that's kind of on the horizon. Maybe next year will be the year we'll see more some actual devices in the mass market with this. 5G. Now, Verizon, I think, already sells a hotspot, and they're doing like a $70 a month for a 5G service. It's expensive. But for phones, we don't anticipate like Apple phones to have 5G because they have beef with Qualcomm, and licensing costs is very high. And next year's 5G smartphones will probably have be less powerful than our current phones in terms of battery life, just because you'll need bigger modems that consume a lot of power.
The infrastructure is not going to be there for 5G to invest in a phone yet.
Is that true about the power? I thought that they were supposed to be more efficient.
More power usage, smaller batteries. So,
If you could buy an Android 5G phone, and it, say we had great service throughout the city, would that be enough to make you switch to Android?
No.
You don't think so? I mean, it may be the kind of thing that's like, once you taste it, you can't go back. But I'm probably with you on that. I'm not sure.
It really depends for like if video continues to become a bigger and bigger part of internet consumption mobily, then maybe.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think, like, what would... Where are slowdowns happening right now?
I think it's mostly, well, I mean, outside of range-related, you know, small areas that you don't get service, it's just got to be video where I get choppiness.
Even video right now, it's not, like LTE, if you have a good LTE signal, you can get 4K video, no problem. The bit rates are not that high for streaming video. I think it's more about if you could use this type of connection as almost like external storage, to a point where it's as fast as, maybe not as fast as a flash drive, but as fast as maybe a spinning disk drive.
You mean just accessing cloud storage super quickly?
Cloud storage or whatever storage you have at home, and be able to work off of. And you can't do that right now. Like, even if a gigabit internet connection, I don't think necessarily 1 gigabit, definitely not for like photo video editing, mm-hmm. right? But if you could do photo editing, video editing off like a 10 gigabit connection, which is technically doable, having that in wireless would be a big game changer.
I look forward to the Internet of Things actually getting more affordable to develop, because right now you can buy microcontrollers that are cell enabled, but there's a subscription fee that's not, it's cheap, but it's, you still think about it. Like, I want, and maybe, you know, it's like $3 a month or something like that for a device that can talk to the cloud over cellular from anywhere. And I guess it's not that much money, but I would like it to be even less than that. And it's, when we can get to the point where it's pennies to have, you know, an Arduino that's cloud enabled over cellular from anywhere, I think that's going to be huge for consumers and makers. That's what I look forward to. And I guess 5G is supposed to be cheaper on the provider side, because it's so much bandwidth.
Hmm. Well, they're still going to charge an arm and a leg initially for early adopters. So that's how capitalism works. Twitter users, talking about feeling old and outdated.
Mm-hmm.
Twitter users, if you're using the app in the U.S., you may have the option to turn on back reverse chronological feed.
Right.
And without the ranked feed. How do you guys feel about this?
You know what? I didn't know this wasn't an option. I was browsing through Twitter the other day looking for a post that I'd seen previously, and I couldn't find it.
Real tough.
And I realized I was getting these were not in order. And so, yeah, I'm glad to see it.
This is a smart move because there's all sorts of tendencies right now to have the web return to a more privacy-based, kind of simpler time kind of model.
Well, I think from a user perspective, the trade-offs are there's two big trade-offs. One, users think a certain way. And maybe there's a distinguishing, maybe it's different between old people and young people, but people who remember, who use blogs and reverse chronological blog, the flow of a new post on top, old post on bottom, the way you categorize and inventory information that you read on blogs or information on your Twitter feed is spatial. You think, you see posts in relation to others, you think of how which ones you saw first. And so when you have that locked in to your specific feed, that's how you can organize or retain data, even subconsciously.
I mean, right? Most sites are still like that. Like Tested is like that.
No, absolutely. But, you know, remember when Gawker experimented with without doing reverse blog flow and having just like this two-panel system that was tablet featured, right? And the counter argument, though, to not having reverse blog, reverse river chronological style feed of information is seeing new things. Because unless you're following enough people, the rank system gets you more fresh stories and you're hitting your endorphins on getting new information, new images more frequently. And you're encouraged to use the app more. And some people like that. Some people don't like the fact that, you know, if when you're refreshing Twitter, closing it and opening it a minute later, you're not seeing something new.
Even a second later. It's annoying to me when I see a story I wanted to click on, hit the back button, and it's gone.
Yeah.
Because it's been reshuffled.
Yes, and that goes to the first point of the spatial organizing of how you retain data, right?
It also doesn't just give me a clean look at the people I follow. It gives me an edited version based off of who I'm interacting with more. And that's not always what I want, because sometimes I want the hockey stuff. Sometimes I want the science stuff. Sometimes I want the hockey science stuff.
Yeah.
Remember Sphero?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you guys were one of the first people to open up a Sphero.
Back
in the day.
This is 3 years ago was when The Force Awakens came out. So yesterday we
were
recording this?
Yeah, sounds right. Because I saw a lot of Last Jedi love this week.
And that was 2 years after Force Awakens.
Yep.
And with the release of Force Awakens, one of the big consumer product launch was the BB-8 Sphero. And
brilliant move.
They since have doubled down on those devices.
Yeah, because they must have sold a ton of those BB-8s.
They sold a ton, and then with Last Jedi, they tried to do the follow-up, the Imperial
BB-8.
I think it's a different designation.
It is.
And then they have the Cars toy, robots. Basically, they're a robotics company.
The R2-D2 is amazing. It's got the third leg that comes out, and it can run around, and it does the dance. It'll fall down.
But unfortunately, none of those sold well enough.
Yeah.
And they're going to discontinue all licensed products.
So what does that mean for Sphero?
Well, they're going to shift to more education robots. They have one. I think there's a...
STEM toys are big?
Yeah. The Bolt, which is a Sphero with a tiny display on the inside. And you can get in the program, do some...
what'd you say? Get in the program?
You can get them. You can program them to get them to go swarm.
No.
Swarming bots would be amazing.
Maybe that's... I think that's
swarming
next.
Swarming Spheros.
You can actually do that pretty cheap. I'm actually sort of surprised that isn't a toy yet. With a few pieces of information, you can create some swarming behavior if you have enough cheap bots. I think this is personally a story of how expensive that Star Wars license is.
Yeah, and how much money Disney was taking. And Disney was an investor in Sphero. That was one of the big success stories, right? Of Disney investing in this company to time it perfectly with the release of Force Awakens. Well, the Sphero, they've announced that they are not renewing their Disney license, so no more Disney branded stuff, and they'll be at CES in a few weeks where they'll be showing off Steam products.
Cool. I'm glad they're just shifting gears.
Yeah.
They make good stuff.
I think that actually does it for us for technology news this week.
Okay.
And before we move on to our next segment, I want to thank the other sponsor that makes this episode possible, and that's Lutron's Caseta Smart Lighting System. Because Caseta by Lutron takes your smart speaker, Alexa, Google Home, Apple HomePod, and makes it more powerful by letting you control your lights with your voice. Caseta is the most connected smart lighting brand, and it works with smart home devices, more smart home devices than any other smart lighting brand, letting you pair lights with other things like security devices, thermostats, and music systems like Nest, Sonos, and more. And because it's from Lutron, you can rest easy knowing it'll just work. With Caseta, you can schedule your lights to come on at dusk so your family always comes back to a well-lit home. Or for me, when we have a crying baby in our arms and we're trying to get sleep and we can't dim the lights, we can just use our Alexa to dim the lights. So get a smart lighting the smart way with Caseta by Lutron. Search for Caseta, that's C-A-S-E-T-A, or check out Lutron.com to learn more. Caseta by Lutron, welcome home to peace of mind.
I'm a pinball nerd. Pin. Just to my point. Finally, pinball. That makes me very happy.
We don't have a tilt warning often enough on this program, but this week there's a little bit of news. We have the new pack released for Zen Pinball, the Williams Collection. As you may know, Zen Pinball has licensed all of the Williams titles, the Williams Bally classics that you remember. They launched with Medieval Madness, for instance, which is one of the highest, most expensive pinball machines. If you were to buy one, it would cost you $8,000. Now you can get it for $10,000 and in video form. But this week, they've released three more tables. Attack from Mars, which is right up there with Medieval Madness, guys. This is a great, great table by the same designer, by the way, Brian Eddy. And they also have Party Zone, which is this quirky game, which is a lot of fun, as well as what's the pirate one? I never remember the name of it. It is Black Rose, and it's a great collection. I keep waiting for these guys to release the VR versions. They haven't announced anything, but
is it part of the plans though?
Not officially, not yet. But they want to. They just don't know if there's enough demand for it yet. And I, you know, that's VR right now. There's just chicken and egg. So, chickens, let them know. Get on Twitter. Ask for the VR version of Zen Pinball, the Williams Collection, because I'm telling you, they're doing a great job. These games are well worth your $10 just to play on the PC screen. If it was in VR, it would be even better, much better, in my opinion. Also, Norm linked to a pretty interesting video. There's a pinball factory in Shenzhen, China. They're making the Thunderbirds. I never watched the Thunderbirds. Did you guys watch it?
I didn't watch it either.
TV show?
Predated me.
Was it the new version on Amazon Studios? But
is it postdated me a little
from
bit
the
too?
'60s.
Yeah.
Puppets.
Quirky show. Quirky game. But they're apparently it's interesting video because it's the only pinball factory really outside of America, and they did it there because the parts are available. Less expensive, but also there's so much labor talent there. And they talk about how it's not cheap labor. It's just that's where the skills are. Mm-hmm. And so they moved the factory there and they ship all over the world from there. I played the game last year at Pinburg, that pinball competition I went to, and it's a decent game. And the game's not terribly, overpriced.
This is from the Strange Parts series, the guy that did the build an iPhone.
Build iPhone from parts, yeah, in Shenzhen.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
This is his series? That was a good video. Wow, that's cool. It's an interesting story. Good video to watch. Inside China's only pinball factory, if you want to Google that one.
Now it's time for a moment of science.
I'm actually going to end up skipping Moment of Science this week because we're running a little short on time. But I am going to be doing a Twitter countdown of some of my favorite stories from science this year.
Mm.
Only half of them make you want to kill yourself because of how just, desperate they are. But some of them are just amazing. And just to give you a sneak peek, I really think we have forgotten to herald the Parker Solar Probe. That was one of the biggest launches of the year, but it gets oftentimes covered up by Everything else that's been happening with SpaceX and what happened with the Soyuz capsule. I think that's a really important moment.
Not to mention Mars Insight.
For solar, yeah, and Mars Insight, of course, for solar astronomy in the future. And there's just some really interesting work that's being done on Antarctica. So I will get out my diagram of Antarctica to show off a few things on Twitter this week.
Tested zone Ariel just got back from Antarctica.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear
we
some
might
of her
be
stories.
Recording a special episode of Still Untitled with Adam Gaughan, but Will and I and Ariel will be talking and hearing about her adventures.
Excellent.
That sounds awesome. There are also a lot of great, you know, best stories, best books of the year when it comes to science. I encourage everyone to check it out.
Oh, is that all you're going to say?
Yep.
Woo! I was not ready for that one.
The VR Minute. Virtual reality this week.
Did you read this article?
I did. It was a blog post by Palmer Luckey,
founder of Oculus.
And he's still blogging about experimenting, tinkering with VR headsets, including the Oculus Go. And he did a modification to his Go, kind of an extreme, a couple extreme modifications, right? He tried to redistribute the weight by putting the battery on the back of the head as opposed to in front of the headset.
Also increasing the battery size, which is smart.
Yes, about longer battery life, totally great. And also the redid the heat sinks, the heat pipes for the cooling on this, because right now the Oculus Go does passive cooling on the front with the metal. And so that apparently took enough off the weight to make it more comfortable to wear. I'm curious why he didn't also redo the straps and give it like rigid straps or something.
Yeah, that's what I'd like to see.
That's a big thing.
I mean, you might do that instead of redistributing the weight because it's going to be enough.
Yeah, I don't think it's that heavy with as it is.
But he also
definitely could use the straps. But yes.
He also made it black.
That's the thing. He dyed the whole unit and the facial interface black because he thinks even the smallest bit of reflectivity of light bouncing in can take away from immersion.
That seems over the top.
I think it's over the top.
Weight stuff, I at least understand.
Right.
The black thing didn't make any sense.
The other thing that he talked about is acknowledging that having not adjustable IPD on the Go makes it not usable for a small percentage of people, himself included, at least discomfort. But thankfully, you know, the Quest will have that. And I don't think he didn't take it on himself to add adjustable IPD to this device.
He did mention, though, that the original Rift has it, and they take a lot of pride in that, that they satisfy, you know, 90% of all people with their IPD adjustment.
I think he said it was going to follow up with a post about trying to add 6 degrees of freedom tracking using a third-party sensor on the Go as well.
Yeah.
Is that it for VR? VR talk?
You have a projections episode coming out this week.
We are shooting an episode right after this podcast, so we'll be talking actually a lot about AR on that episode.
That's augmented reality, Kishore.
Some people might call it MR, mixed reality.
Microsoft calls it mixed reality, but they also call it VR mixed reality.
I think Magic Leap also calls it mixed reality.
Do they?
Yeah.
I think
it's funny. When people are locked into their terminology, they will refuse to use another terminology. You'll never hear anyone who at Magic Leap call it augmented reality. Huh.
Maybe you have to invent your own.
OR. What's that? O for stand for?
No, it's just OR.
Original reality.
Yeah.
The Spider-Verse. That's what I want. I want the Spider-Verse reality.
You've gone full circle.
Yeah.
Let's go over this one more time.
Very nice. Yeah. Very nice. One final time. Well, that does it this week, and it may be it for us for this year on This Is Only a Test. I want to thank you all out there for joining us every week. Thank you for listening. Hope you had a good time hearing us chat about things related to pop culture, tech, top stories of every week, VR, and we're going to come back fresh next year with more conversation. We're not going to CES, so we'll be maybe just reading up on some of the reports from CES. And for those of you who subscribe to our YouTube channel, over the next week we'll be releasing our favorite things of 2019. The tested contributors, people in this room included, will talk and share about some of their favorite, not just tech, but favorite things they've purchased, things they've discovered, and things that made a difference in their lives.
And why Norm should just agree that Infinity War was the best superhero film of the
year.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Spoiler, Kishore does feature a purple character
Yeah.
In his favorite things. Just
it's all about Barney the dinosaur.
It's Grimace. It's about Grimace, right? Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot, everyone. You got an outro for us, Jeremy?
From Mad Cat.
Hi there. I didn't see you.
Have you beat the dragon? No. Talk to a magic frog. Make awesome. A fire sword.
He's the genie, right? That guy talking.
I know what I'm doing tonight.
Beating the dragon?
Talking to a magic frog. See you guys next year. Bye.